Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Beverly Singer. She's Associate Professor of Anthropology and Native American Studies at the University of New Mexico. And I'm very happy to welcome two guests from Kenya. Yvonne Owor is an award-winning author from Kenya, and Shuel Njalis is the director of the Ilungwesi Lodge in Kenya. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with you, Beverly. You've brought our two new friends from Kenya to New Mexico. How did you meet?
Several years ago, I was invited by the UNESCO to present on indigenous filmmaking. And this was a meeting that they sponsored in the country of Andorra and also in Spain. And I made my presentation, and immediately afterward, there were these two incredible people looking at me and said, "We're ready to work with you." And I said, "Absolutely." Mm-hmm. And what we began there in about 2006 was a lifelong relationship in terms of talking about each other as indigenous people. But I knew then, and we know now, that they are here in New Mexico, that our connections were very, very old, that our relationship to land and to community and to our own families were really the source of, you know, our connecting as people who really wanted to share each other's stories. And as a filmmaker, I knew that, you know, it would be this huge leap of faith for me to not only travel to Kenya, I had already been to South Africa and had an amazing experience there, but to really travel into the heart of Africa itself, which I feel Kenya is one of those places now that I've been there. And I visited Shuel's community of Ilungwesi in August of 2009, and I went there because we had stayed in email communication through all these years, sharing our experiences and what was happening in our lives. But we had also planned to work together on a film project. And I wanted to take the skill that I had and share it with Shuel's community. And so in visiting there, I took cameras with the intention of actually putting them in the hands of the people there. And once I was there, it was the most natural experience because they had seen so many people at their in their community with cameras, but never were taking the pictures themselves.
It's such a natural thing to do, and yet something that a lot of filmmakers don't think of, which is to relinquish control of the film, of the image, of the way the narrative is going to be done.
Mm-hmm. And secondly, when I arrived there, I was welcomed and greeted by these beautiful, beautiful songs. And that's the case in Africa, everywhere in the villages, is when you arrive there, the community welcomes you. And I just felt like, you know, this is how it used to be in our community. When visitors came, they would welcome you. And it's still done there in almost every village that you travel to. But more than that, I recognized in our conversations with Shuel and with Yvonne was that there were so many things that people didn't know about Africa. You know, all the incredible richness and aliveness of people there, that there is not this sense of depression or fear or of even being shut down, you know, to new ideas and to new people, you know. And I think that that sense of openness was what really connected us. And so I also was welcomed by Shuel's community there at Ilungwesi, because what they did was they had begun in the 60s an entire eco-conservation project on their own territory where they began to organize, and I'm going to let him tell you sort of a short narrative of how they started an actual eco-lodge and has become an internationally renowned place where, you know, it's the destination of people like Prince William and others. But, you know, it far exceeds the expectation of safari lodge idea
right. That
was established early on.
Well, maybe you can tell us about this eco lodge. Was this the lodge featured in the film Milking the Rhino?
Sure, it was featured.
Because we had Gina McGill on the air a couple of years ago to talk about that film. So tell us, this is ecotourism. You don't think of that as something that began in the 1960s. I thought it was a more recent development.
Conservation is part of our culture, and it is it's been there since when the old days before conservation was put in books and people started reading about conservation. It is an integral part of our culture. It is something that we lived. It is in us. We walk, we sleep, and we laugh, and we meet people in using conservation. So just to begin talking about this lodge is that this facility was put up in through support of friends of Ilmwesi, who came to recognize the essence of conservation, the way the Ilmwesi people had done it in the 60s, back in the old times, when no one recognized these ideas. There came some people who recognized this community, and they were able to live well with the wildlife and even coexist well with the wildlife that live in the land, as well as even undertake proper environmental management practices that go well with pastoralism and wildlife conservation, as it were. So the two things they could not, the people who visited us really were amazed by this concept that it was possible to continue living in a communal land with cattle, with the wildlife roaming around the place and even mingling with people. And this idea, this gave back to an idea of why don't we look for a small tree and convert it into a homestead where people would be hosted, and other indigenous communities in the world, people from all over the world would come and visit and get a chance to interact with the local people, with their cattle, with their lifestyles, and an opportunity for them to share who they are with the other, the people outside the community. So this led to the establishment of this ecolodge, and we were not establishing it because we had no other other lodge to look at up to, or any other facility to copy from or to learn from.
Right.
So we just started from nowhere and from what we've been doing all through. The style we've used to host our people when they visit us, because we had visitors. We are Africans, and we have had visitors all over the place, from Kikuyu, from Luo, from name all the tribes that we neighbor us. And they do visit us, and the way we welcome them, the way we host them, is the same concepts that have been brought into this facility. And we use our hands, our labor, our morans, our women to be able to put up this facility and even to manage it. And as it is now, it is the only community lodge that has been built, not only managed, built. The idea was with the community, and they built it themselves, and they started running it themselves, and up to date, they are still the one owning and running this facility. And they use it as an opportunity to meet with other people, to host their visitors, the people who visit them, their beloved visitors. And through this process, they get into an opportunity to interact with other people across the world and learn from other people, much as also they give their stories of the land to other people and share these stories around a traditional fire in the evening, get an opportunity to be able to move forward. And this is how we met Beverly. So when Beverly came, we shared our stories with her, and be in a very organic way, be able to interact with her as one of us who has been from a very, very far off land. It took us time to prepare. We knew she was coming, and we've been waiting, anticipating her all the days until when she arrived. And we were happy to have her in our board, in our land.
What I experienced when I arrived there also was the fact that these were people just like my people in the Pueblo territories here in New Mexico. But they were living in the manner of their ancestors, our ancestors, where they went to the river to get the water, right? Where they were still without any communication, electricity or phones or any of those distractions of the world, and out on living with the land and the animals. And to see herds of elephant and giraffe and the gazelles and all the other animals that come through there, the water buffalo, just migrating through, you just think to yourself, everywhere on the ground you see the footprints of all these animals, and you are just in this, you're taken into a different realm of time. And so it's as if though you're suspended, you know, away from all of the conventions that you think of about thought and life. And I think, you know, that was almost so clear that, you know, there was this this sense of not having given up anything, you know, in order to actually build a foundation, you know, that would create a center of life and welcoming, like at the Ilongwesi Lodge. And I could go on and on about the incredible dimensions of the place, but I also want to include Yvonne here because she's been working with Ilongwesi on a number of different projects as well. Because these are people who are so willing to listen. You know, no one has the time anymore to just go sit under the tree and talk and share stories, and that's what we did.
How did you, Yvonne, get involved with the lodge?
I'd heard of Ilongwesi, just in the press. I've been involved in conservation and, I guess, human-wildlife issues for a long time. And we just out of personal interest, and because, I guess, being a Kenyan, these are part of the archetypes and metaphors that are a part of our, you know, a part of our lives. So I'd heard of Ilongwesi long before I went to Ilongwesi. And when a friend came back from Ilongwesi raving about the space, and I'd been mildly cynical of the whole kind of community lodge concept, where you have somebody with a lot of money coming in, landing in a community they imagine is rather exotic, and who have, you know, tracts of land, pump money in, and you import managers from all parts of the world rather than the community themselves being a part of the vision for, you know, the management of these lodges. So when this friend said, actually, Ilongwesi is different. This is owned by, visioned by the Ilongwesi people. I had to go for myself and see. And by wonderful coincidence, UNESCO was going to run a project, needed to run an ICT for Indigenous Peoples project. And in my past life, I've been a screenwriter, and I've got a real passion for technology as a mediator of worlds and possibilities. So I got involved in that project, and we went there with the UNESCO team. And it was, what an incredible encounter, not only of landscape, but an affirmation of possibilities that occur when people are... It's not about given a chance as much as when people take charge of their particular destinies and landscapes.
Shuel, well, you started off talking about how conservation is a much older way of life and way of thinking among your people than the modern conservation and ecological movement. What do you mean? What does that look like? How has conservation always played a role in the way that you live?
Conservation is enshrined, and it's part of the culture, and as old as even the culture in my place. I'll give you an example. When I grew up in Ilongwesi, my father would tell me during the dry periods that you cut a tree not by the stem, but by the branch. That in itself was conservation. It was a concept put me at a very tender age, at a very informal age, and I grew up with all that, knowing so many things about that that I have to coexist. That the environment, the space I have, is a God-given space, within which I have to share with my other human beings, with the wild animals, with all that God has created and put into that piece of land. So it's not something I read in books and begin doing it. It's something that was with my ancestors, with my father, and came down to me, and it's passed on to the generations after me even. So it's something, it's inseparable with the culture of my people, the Ilongwesi Maasai. And it's cutting across all the Maasai people. It is it's something that is not taught in books. Those who have not gone to school are able to practice it, and they understand the concept of conservation more than even those who have gone to school. And I think when I went to school and started reading about conservation, it's not something new. It's something that I knew long before going to school myself. So when this idea of conservation, in quotes, started, people started talking about it and as something that is new, brought from somewhere people read and, you know, started writing so many things about it. We were laughing at personally, I laugh at them and because I know what they're saying is my grandfather knew, my great grandfather was practicing the same thing, only that he had no opportunity to put that into writing and to express it and to share it with other people. This eco facility now which has become a melting point, a meeting point for so many of us, and has become a template for other communities to learn from and to grow in and to begin looking at from within themselves. It has become an opportunity for us to express what has been in our culture, to show Yvonne, to show Beverly, to show other people, and to show even yourself what we've been doing, or the century old age practices of conservation that are ingrained in our culture. Mm-hmm. So it is part of us.
And it's so amazing because there's also the colonial history of the British in the area, of course, with all of the hunting that was done, of the extermination of many of the animals,
the species.
And, you know, the stories that they tell, you know, of the Ollamagori Hill that we climbed, the mountain there, when I was out there, and one of the stories was that this was the site where when a safari hunter couldn't find a particular beast that it wanted, you know, it would shoot the mountain. You know, and just really kinds of very, and they have those narratives as well, but this is a much deeper sort of narrative that they are telling.
Just expanding on what Shaul's talking about, the notion of conservation within the African landscape, the fact that we each have, no matter which African community you're talking to or talking about, animal totems are very much a signifier of each one of our lives. Or our names, the incorporation of the names of animals. But more than that, it's not just animals. It's the notion of what is the meaning of a particular animal, and what's that the meaning of that animal in your life, or in your community, or in your culture. Names like Ondiek in my culture means hyena. People are actually called Ondiek. Somebody like my mom will joke about there's a particular python that used to come around her community, a kind of precursor to rain. And a few years ago, somebody lit the bushes and the snake was burnt, not to death. Her name is Omieri. So we were teasing mom, and mom says, "You don't laugh. That's your grandmother." So and the fact of the coexistence of species, which is perhaps something that's very significantly African, I must say that only because I mean, by the beginning of the 20th century, I think most of Europe and a lot of the US had killed most of their large species. There's a lot of knowledge and insight and a way of being embedded in a lot of our own cultures, and I think the power of Ngwesi is that it's an example of how to live in that way in a very contemporary space, despite all the pressures of the contemporary world.
One of the things before we went on the air, you and I were having an interesting conversation about how you grew up in Nairobi. You're an urban girl. You love Macintosh computers and software and hardware and technology and all those kinds of things.
Yes.
But you and many other urban people in Kenya, in Africa, have dual identities, both urban and rural. What does that look like? What is that like?
Our marvelous schizophrenia, in a very positive way. hard to say what it looks like. It's just an awareness of the different selves one has. So suddenly, what else does it look like? It means that every time I walk, I travel easily all over the world, and I assume whatever identity I need for that particular space. I think.
Do you have relatives, for example, in the countryside?
Oh yes, I do, absolutely, and deep connections that there. I know, for example, that as a member of the Luo community, that I'll always have to make references to that. When you meet a person, the first thing in Kenya, some of the question you're asked is not just your name. Who are you? Whose daughter are you? Where are you from? The whole idea of the person and the place, the identity of person and place being very blurred. And when we're being lighthearted, we say Nairobi is the house. Kisumu, wherever the rural place is home. And home is where the umbilical cord of the ancestors are. Home is the place where you go to get buried, no matter where you are in the world. Yeah.
Or do you see parallels to the indigenous world of, for example, the Southwest, Beverly?
Absolutely. It's the same. I would say that for many young Native people today, I mean, their experience is definitely the same. They are in the world of, you know, computers and games and, you know, television or whatever else is out there that sort of keeps them occupied at that level. But they know that, you know, home is also at the, you know, in their own communities. Here's in the Pueblo communities, you know, where our ceremonial life is and our what remains of our elders, you know, and those old stories. And I think that that's what is reignited in me, is that hearing the old stories from Swell's community that I heard, is that I wanted to come back and sort of ignite that in my own family and then beyond, you know. And it's very hard to do when you are separated from that, because it seems as if, though, new media in its own way, you know, its colonizing powers is very strong, you know, and it really does keep you occupied and does not want you to go back to an older time when you have to sit and listen and be quiet and be still and behave.
We're talking to Beverly Singer from the University of New Mexico and Yvonne Uwar and Shuel Njalis from Kenya. Now, Shuel, the lodge, the Il Ningwesi Lodge in Kenya, which is an eco-lodge and serves tourists from all over the world, it was conceived by African people in a community way to solve some real problems. What were the problems in that area that you were trying to solve by having this lodge, and where did those problems come from?
One of the main reason why we set up this facility was, first of all, to provide livelihood, an alternative livelihood system. Because, as I said, we are predominantly a pastoralist community, meaning we rely 100% on our cattle for sustenance, to meet our daily needs. So this one was just creating another alternative and perhaps giving a chance for us to explore other opportunities and connect with other people in the world, both within the country, within Kenya, and within Africa as a region and worldwide. This lodge has provided an opportunity for us. It has become a second tree, a second cow. One, a second tree, because it has provided a chance to dialogue. In that ecology, we've been able to dialogue with so many people, Yvonne, Beverly, and all other people who have been visiting this space of ours. At the same time, it has provided a chance for us to make an alternative livelihood for both for ourselves and the children that are coming behind us, in the sense that in this age and times, we do relying on one particular way of living. We're not secure properly to be able to continue just in one way. So we thought, because of the droughts and the famines that have been visiting our land, sometimes sweep our animals and, you know, decimate all our animals. And then what are the opportunities left for us? Some of them, you know, some of the masses end up becoming watchmen in Nairobi and in big cities, and because they do not have other ways, they do not have skills to be able to be usefully engaged in other activities. So this lodge is providing an opportunity for us to mitigate this immigration to the urban areas and begin doing things that are not in the right way. So we are saying this facility is providing a chance for us to utilize what we know best, and share this what we know best with other people, and in so doing, create opportunities and avenues for us to engage and also make living an alternative living out of the same place. At the same time, this facility has given us a chance to of course, share and preserve, because in sharing, in being able to give, then you are able to retain. You're able to to understand the value of your culture, the value of your ethos, the value of your system, and all the things that are important to you. And if this facility was not available, then it means that over time we would begin doing it in our own homes and eventually it would just die. So it is provided a chance, an opportunity for us to share who we are, share our stories about our land, share our stories about our space with our brothers from all over the world and our sisters from all over the world, both within our country, within Africa, and far.
And does the lodge also, in some ways, accomplish conservation of land and animals and things like that?
Yes, absolutely. It does. It is. When we started, we had in the 60s, the people now who have turned themselves into conservationists were busy killing the rhinos. Ingwesi particularly was a space, a renowned space for rhino breeding up northern Kenya. It was one of the sites that rhino came to me to mate and to reproduce. And during the times when so many people came to into that space, a lot of rhino were killed, not only rhino, even elephants, and all the other animals were almost decimated.
Now, are you talking killed. About and colonialism, hunters,
yes,
things
exactly,
like that?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And even in Kenya systems, there was a time we had
even
sport hunting.
Post-colonial,
we had sport hunting, where the government would give licenses to some people to come and shoot and pay revenue to the government. And during that process, all the animals were wiped out. But when we began this process of, again, reconstructing our own conservation ethos and giving it a life through our own ways, we've seen animals coming back. A lot of elephants. If you visit Ingwesi, you could have even, you could see up to almost 600 in April particularly. This is a season when they come to breed, breeding season for them. A lot of other wildlife species have come, gerenuks, rhino, even retraced back to their original habitat. They are, you know, we have one black rhino and two white rhinos that are within our space. And generally speaking, there's been an improved presence of a diverse group of wildlife species that have come back to our land because of what we've been doing.
I just love that when you basically don't kill them and just leave some space, they come back and proliferate. It doesn't take that much. Just providing space and leaving them alone, wildlife will do its own thing and find its own way.
Sure, yes. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely, true. You're right. And it is, it's not done in a fancy way. It's not land. It's, we have not fenced the land so that then we know the animals are protected using guns and stuff like that. We've been able to just provide the environment and the chance for them to live because they also have got rights to live in the same land we are living. It's part of recognizing that it's not only us human beings who have got the right to live on that land, to access the natural resources that we are there. Even the God-created animals, the wildlife, have got similar rights to be able to exist in that land, to partake, and even all our stories, the stories of the Ingwesi Maasai will not be what it is today, why not for those wildlife? You know, these wildlife species gave us a chance to make stories. They were even instrumental in shaping our culture and shaping our ceremonies. Most of our ceremonies had also animals, elements incorporated in them. If you do not have these animals in our land, then it means, of course, our culture will continue going down. It's going to be watered down and eventually die off. So there's a correlation of the presence of this wildlife and the compactness of the culture of the local people, including myself, the Ingwesi people. So when these animals leave the land, it gets to the culture loosens up, and even the humanity loosens up, because culture is what makes me respond to you as a friend or as a neighbor in a different way that is humanly. So if I lose that animal, I'll also lose the connection between human beings, the two connections that makes people human. So that's very essential to us, and that is why we felt it's an opportunity for us to again recreate and to continue the continuity of that culture is going to be more enhanced by the establishment of this facility.
And
because in that it provides an opportunity, it provides incentive for our young people and our young women to really keep in touch with the environment, to really keep in touch with their culture as well.
And it's also an inspiration to other types of community-based eco-lodges or ecological facilities throughout Africa.
Absolutely. Ingwesi is now renowned, is the undisputed template in Africa, from where all other communities in Africa have come to learn and borrow. What is it that is magic about this place? is a magical space because the people have not had any other, they have utilized what they know, their own culture, their own landscape, their own wallet, to be able to create something that is that recreates and gives back human beings the soul and the ancestry.
I was going to say there's like 300 or 400 different species of birds, and one that I remember was the go-away bird. And the story associated with the go-away bird had to do with the
go-away. The go-away
bird. That's the
okay.
English name for, you know, the whatever, common name for this bird. But it's just a gorgeous turquoise feathered bird. And it actually has a nest with two holes, two entrances, and that is so that it can escape. It goes in one and can escape on the other. But more than that, the reason it's called that is because when there's danger coming, it makes very loud squawking noises, and that's where it got its name go away from. But, you know, as I was walking through the territory, you know, and sort of connecting as I had another young Maasai, Kashina Lawrence, taking me around with Shwell one morning, and we just walked for 2 or 3 hours, and we saw every species come through, but it was very clear that the animals there were very happy, you know. And I think that what she was talking about is this sense of, you know, having this mutual respect and love for each other, and accepting that this is their territory first. And in the native societies here in the United States, and especially among our people, our narrative stories say that the animals were here first, you know, and they were the ones who set sort of the parameters for the earth itself, and you can feel that still alive in this territory.
It's funny how evolutionary science and native wisdom are pretty much the same on that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, these native wisdoms were around in place, as Shwell is saying, for, you know, thousands of years.
We're talking to Beverly Singer from the University of New Mexico and Ivan Awar and Shwell Njalis from Kenya. So I've never been there. I've been looking at the website of this lodge and trying to think of what it's like to go there and the beauty of it and the animals and the size of it. But one thing that I was also struck by is, okay, these are luxury accommodations where Americans and Europeans and people with money can go and stay in nice places and have running water and good food and all those things. How is it like the old colonialism, and how is it different?
I know colonialism has got a lot of bad flack, but maybe it's a meeting place of concepts that makes sense. Or a contemporary space, the realities. I think the thing about Ngwesi and places like that, it has to be grounded in reality. the economic structure and the paradigms of growth have changed. You're dealing with national systems that make certain demands. And it is the community, the whole idea of the dynamism of culture and the community response to the environment in which it finds itself, and asks itself, okay, what can we do? What can we use that belongs to us that will sustain or perpetuate a way of seeing and being? And how? And what are the expectations of the outside world on us? Quite frankly, if that space was not utilized, the pressure on land in Kenya is immense. The pressure of lobbies, a lot of lobbies, external lobbies, especially the sports hunting lobby, to have a hunting return is equally immense. And if there were not, if spaces like this did not exist in which the alternative was presented and the alternative worked and made sense for members of communities such as Shwell's and others, I imagine, I think it would probably be, the whole idea of coexistence of species would be a lost cause.
Right.
Yeah.
But more than that, I think, is that, you know, this is territory that is actually held communally by the Ilongwesi Maasai people, about 6,000, I would say, people.
Sure, sure.
And the fact that, you know, they are protected in terms of this being their territory, their land base. The fact that they constructed this themselves, you know, and designed it through their own imagination and their own hands and minds, and keep it going, and have added new layers of experience for travelers there. Yes, it does have that sense of that old, you know, colonial idea about a tourist destination. But what they have done is they've revisioned it for themselves. They're doing it in their own terms. you know, and no one has come in there and said, this is how you're supposed to do it. And so everything that is done there is done in an Ilongwesi way, from the service, from the meeting, from the way that you are interacted with and taken to one of the villages that does allow them to visit a particular Ilongwesi village, because the lodge is very separate from the communities. The communities still live in their various villages, and the Bomas out in the outlying area. And there's huge respect for that. And the people themselves really maintain, you know, recognizing that this is something that any resources that are made, funds that are come up and above the annual reports that come in when they get the money and see what they have, it goes back into community projects there in the territory for water works, for education, for health, for, you know, for those kinds of things that are all community-based projects.
Including infrastructure development.
Yes.
That place, the university space, was never opened until when we had this facility. And this has happened now. We have a small airstrip. That means if somebody gets a problem, it can be airlifted and taken to a more better facility for treatment. While before this facility came, was here, we didn't have that kind of facility. Roads have been opened up. So it's true. This has provided an opportunity for us to claim our space and position in the national development agenda, as well as in the global economic structures that now part of our living.
Sometimes in communities, and I've seen this in different places that I've traveled, tourism brings in money, but it's also a mixed blessing because inequalities of wealth are created very quickly. Now, maybe that's solved by all the money going right back into the community, but do you have to deal with that problem of some people or groups of people being wealthier than others because of this tourist money?
Certainly, it's not an issue in university because the benefit sharing arrangement is structured in such a way that all the benefits that come eventually are spread up into the entire community. Besides paying, you know, of course, the people who are working, the one who are providing day to day services, and of course paying the government taxes and complying with all the tax regulations in the land that in the state that we live in, the Kenya state, the residue, whatever is left, the bottom figure, is invested in projects that have got a multiplier effect, like in water projects. So we do not provide dividends like a conventional company. The benefits are invested in projects that have got, that everyone is going to benefit in schools, in bursaries, in health programs, and in all things that support the livelihood of local people. Truly speaking, myself here speaking, I've been able to go to school through a bursary scheme that has been started by that project. And when I finished schooling, I felt a call to go back and give back to my community. And so many of them are even now in school, and they still come back and volunteer and give back to their community. So that way, we open up Ilongwesi people to the world, the present world, while at the same time retain that communal living, that communal understanding, that communal sharing. So there's no problem about who becomes rich, because at the end of it all, it's not given, that money does not go to any one particular person. Apart from maybe what you paid for providing the service, the rest of it goes to fund projects that benefit the entire community. So there's no one who has gotten rich because of the money. Right. You know, maybe if you invest your salary or you invest whatever you paid, then you could make some improvement in life. But you know, besides that, you know, the entire thing goes up. Because the decision-making organs are still the traditional organs, the elders. Involved in making decisions. The elders and the women of our land are the ones who decide what is the best way to go and invest the kind of money we generate and what we do. So they set priorities together with the community, of course. Every neighborhood is given a chance to... We have neighborhoods or forums of neighborhoods across the land where people create a forum to be able to articulate what needs to be prioritized for support by the money generated from the university.
They actually go and sit under the tree, 300 people, and sit there for weeks on end and talk and decide what they're going to do.
Yvonne, you are a writer. You are, in addition to being involved in this in Wesi Lodge and being a Apple computer geek and all sorts of other things, you are an award-winning fiction writer. And I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about the literary community in Kenya and your part in it.
Okay. I was lucky to be a part of the revival of the arts in a very big way in Kenya, especially after 2003 when we thought we'd voted in a new dispensation. There was such an explosion right across the artistic sector. And foremost was the literary movement that fell under the umbrella of Kwani. Kwani meaning kind of like what's up. It started off as a journal, but became a kind of literary thing. And and actually my own literary life began with Kwani. And all sorts of incredible stuff, new writing emerging that is probably more navel gazing oriented rather than dealing with the colonial past or whatever. Well, we certainly look forward to the possibility that in the next couple of years there will be a lot of books certainly flowing all over the world from Kenya. And it's right now very rich.
I mean, it fascinates me. You're writing in English, but the English has a very African character, as you were explaining to me before. The whole way of thinking and using metaphor is distinctly African. And yes. I was wondering if you could just maybe give us some examples of what that looks and feels like in your writing and in the writing of your peers.
I guess I would probably have to read something, but let me try to explain it. I think if you think of English as a kind of like a river, and you're in that river, and what you're looking at, your writing describes your experience of being in that water, and each experience is very unique. It describes the view from the water of what's happening on the edges. And this is very rooted in the particular landscape in which you find yourself. So I may use English, but it's merely the paint that I use to sketch that which I want to express.
Maybe on the website we'll be able to give a link to your work or some of the some of this, so that if people are interested, they can follow it up. Beverly, I wanted to go back to you. You have done something which is rare, which is put cameras in the hands of other people. Tell us about the film that you hoped might come from this.
Well, it's not such a new idea. You know, anthropologists have been putting cameras in hands with people back in the 60s. It was Saul Worth and John Adair who had a project where they had some 8mm film cameras out in the Navajo Reservation. And I think my inspiration actually came from the fact that, I have studied filmmaking and have been a participant in indigenous filmmaking for about 30 years, which is really quite a history all of its own. But I just know that in this day and age that we live, that young people respond to media in a very positive way. And when Shwell and Yvonne and myself talked about, creating a project together, we knew that we wanted to produce some kind of video archive about Ilungwesi for Ilungwesi, but have Ilungwesi do it themselves. And so it was never a question as to whether or not, they would get the cameras in their own hands. It was just when and how to do it. And I think the most important piece of this has to do with the fact that, when I went there, I didn't go as an expert. I went as a community person who cared about people because they were indigenous, but also because I knew that they had things to teach me. And so what I brought was just this, just the tools, And so we would sit there and talk in the afternoon about what was important and what stories they had. And then we would sort of just slowly move into the process rather than workshop or anything like that. And, throughout it, I think, it was amazing, the conversations we had, even about my iPhone, we were trying to connect to that, and the young folks that were working there at the lodge, they just loved it. It was like, it has music, it has internet, it has, you know, all of these things. And they just kind of picked it right up, you know. And so I know that, you know, that's just the tool. That's just the instrument. It's sort of like a ceremony, basically. It's like, you know, all the prayer. It's what's more important is all the good thinking and the prayers and the time and commitment you give to a project rather than the end result being just the film. You know, it's really about building relationship. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I went there with this idea. But we do want to produce a very long documentary, you know, about a year in the life at Ilongwesi. Well, how the people work with the land, how they live there, what happens in that year, whether it's a drought year or whatever. And then the stories that come from that.
And giving a feeling of the time and of the seasons and of the daily life and
exactly.
things like that.
And moving the cattle and the goats along the land. You know, because people still that's the main source of living, is that you have, you know, when I was there, they killed a goat for me, and basically vegetarian, but when I'm there, I'm going to eat the goat, you know? That's what you do. It was just amazing. And dancing with the young people, inviting me in to dance with them. You know, so those are the kinds of connections that I made with the camera. And now, you know, Shuel's brought back some footage, and it's just amazing. You know, to have this, because now I want them to make the decision about how this story should flow in this year. And so I think we'll have it done in about a year.
Yes. And you are required by law to come back on my show when the film is done.
Fabulous. And we'll be showing it in Santa Fe. Yeah. But our gift was that I said, you know, they invited me there, now I invite them here. So that's why Shuel and Yvonne have come to New Mexico.
I think we've had so many filmmakers, international filmmakers, come to Ilongwesi, both as guests and as friends, and even who have expressed their desire to make film. And write something about, to say something about Ilongwesi, and to showcase, to show things about Ilongwesi to the outside world. But I think the approach used by Beverly is empowering. It's been one of the most empowering ones, because he left the camera, even though we do not know how to use it very well, but over time we discovered how to use it.
Yeah.
And through that camera we're able now to speak, give our stories, and then, you know, film ourselves giving our stories, and share this one, and being able to share this with our friends and, of course, the people we're working with.
And, so and with your eye, because no matter how wonderful a cinematographer is, they don't have your sensibility.
Exactly. He, you know, she cannot be able to understand some of the things that that require four eyes to understand. So the four eyes of the culture, you know, something you can just observe and you think you understand them, but you have to go deep to them. So I think the camera, the tools he's given us, the items that he's provided in, has made available to us to use, has really empowered us and has given us a chance to, you know, to see them and to put them in the camera and even to have our voices in there the way we want it.
We just have 1 minute left, but I wanted to ask the two of you, what was it like in where you were the night that Barack Obama was elected?
I think to me that was very, it was the death of racism to me. It was the beginning of the world opened a new chapter by beginning to recognize that all of us, human beings, whether you are yellow, black, white, dark, whatever you are, have got the potential to bring on table of the world something unique. And I think Barack Obama brought something unique to the world. And all of us are happy in Africa that he has got some background right into Kenya.
In Kenya, yeah.
Oh, no, we claim him very assiduously. electrifying, and transformative at a level that I cannot really explain. I think, as Shrill says, the death of the notion of racism. It was very easy to pigeonhole America in a certain way. Oh, to pigeonhole literally the U.S., the Bush years type of thing. And suddenly you're presented with this phenomenon, and you're thinking it's the people, the American people, the people that did this. And you suddenly have to... I know it was electrifying for all of us, and the sheer... the life of possibility. And, We had parties. We did have parties.
Ivana War is an award-winning author from Kenya. Shwel Njalis is director of the Ilingwesi Lodge in Kenya. And Beverly Singer is associate professor of anthropology and Native American studies at the University of New Mexico. And she's a filmmaker. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, too, as well, for giving us the opportunity.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month bassist Dave Holland.